Hi, and welcome to the Interviews with the Masters, brought to you by theoutdoorinsiders.com, your number one spot for inside information and quality gear. Today, we have with us on the phone a good buddy of mine. We've had him on before. This is Matt Woodward, and we have Matt. We have him on today because we're going to talk a little bit about hunting in Mexico, and Matt hunts, guides down there for coos deer, for mule deer, pretty much anything you can hunt down there. Matt's guides down there for you, and I get questions asked of me all the time, you know, how do I go about it, and so on and so forth. So, Matt, how you doing today?
I'm good, John. How are you?
Good. Can't complain, man. Getting ready for deer season. A couple days away.
Fantastic. Yeah, we're doing the same.
Season.
Right around the corner, yep.
Yep. We got that. Well, you got those over-the-counter tags that here in the metro units that I like to hunt that in December, you know.
Awesome, yeah, tons of fun.
So I brought you on today because of your expertise in hunting in Mexico. I always get people asking me questions about it. I have booked a few hunts down there for people, and I work with a few guides down there, including yourself. So I'd like to throw a couple things at you and get some of these things answered for these guys.
Sure, my pleasure.
What are some of the questions? Well, you know, before we get into that, why don't you tell us a little bit about your hunting experience with Mexico, what you guys do down there?
Sure. We're heading into our 11th season here. We actually head up from Mexico tomorrow to kick off some of our December hunts. So we're in our season. We lease ranches kind of throughout Sonora, from the mountain region down all the way down to the coast, all the way up along the border. So we hunt deer in a few different areas, a few different kind of terrain types throughout Sonora. Lease a total of 10 different ranches. And this year we're going to take about 40 coos deer off them total, 39 or 40 deer. So
cool.
We've got a fair amount of experience down there. We've been crossing guns and taking deer back and forth from Mexico for a lot of years now, and got a pretty good process down, and it goes pretty smooth for us.
Good, because nothing about Mexico is smooth.
Yeah, it can be a little tough sometimes.
The last year, I went to go check out a new ranch with a buddy of mine, and it was way down in the tropical belt.
Uh-huh.
And it was an experience. I pretty much got everything that you can think of thrown at me, you know, that Mexico throws at you. I had three flat tires on the way down, had problems at the border. It was a 14-hour drive. You know,
yeah.
It was way to hell down south, just, you know, one thing after another. So it was an experience that I don't think I would like to have ever again. So
it sounds like, yeah.
Yeah, and it can happen. It can happen to, you know.
Sure.
And that's why you want to go down with the right people, and I encourage using a very reputable outfitter such as Matt. And speaking of outfitters, so what are some of the questions a hunter is planning to go to hunt in Mexico be asking their outfitter, their guide?
Sure. You know, it's the general outfitter questions, but there's a few specifics relating to Mexico. There's a few things from a legality standpoint that you want to watch out for. You want to make sure, you know, you want to ask, obviously, you want to ask how long your outfitter's been in business, how long you've had this particular ranch. That's always important to me as far as a track record with the owners and being kind of established there.
Mm-hmm.
How large is the ranch, et cetera. Mostly so that when you get to the ranch, you know that you're hunting on the right ranch and you don't get the old switcheroo pulled on you and you get switched over to some other ranch, and that happens quite a bit. So you want to just kind of keep your ducks in a row on that front. And then just ask the basic questions about, you know, where you're sleeping. What's the house like? Do you need to bring a sleeping bag, or are there linens on a nice bed, or are you going to be on a cot with a half dozen guys in a very small house? And so there's all those kinds of questions that go into Mexico. You know, hunts vary in Mexico so greatly from big hacienda-style homes with all the amenities of home to small little concrete and rock shacks with maybe a stove in them, or a wood stove and maybe wood-fired hot water and just only the very, very basics. So you've got to kind of ask those questions to know what you're really getting yourself into and what you're after, what type of hunt you're after. So those are some things to be grilling your outfitter about and make sure that things are consistent. Mexico's biggest problem outfitting is consistency. And guys, hunting one ranch one year and then getting switched to another ranch and getting bounced around, and guys, outfitters losing ranches and acquiring new ranches. And so you're just looking for some consistency and some sort of a track record, in my opinion. Some guys who've been doing it down there in the same places and they're established and they know the area and that kind of stuff. It's tough to go down on a 7-day hunt with an outfitter exploring new country. It's super risky from a hunting standpoint, from the quality of your hunt standpoint. And so you really want to watch out for that. So,
yeah. And honestly, that's what I had last year. We were going to explore, but I knew it going into it that we were going to explore.
Sure. And we have to do those. Still, we do a lot of those, but not necessarily with booked clients.
No, definitely don't want clients. That's for sure.
But we run into a lot of that where guys are down there and the you know, you've got an outfitter with you that's looking for keys to a ranch at 10 o'clock at night and the night before you're supposed to be start hunting and he's not sure exactly where the ranch is and so on. I hear those kind of horror stories, and you can avoid a lot of that by just making sure that you're with somebody who's got some consistency. And on that note, you know one thing you'll see a ton of advertised, and there's a reason that there's a ton of them out there, is you'll see these new ranches, never been hunted. There's just a lot of these new, never been hunted ranches showing up all the time. Well, there's a reason for that. It's not that they're necessarily a new ranch. They've been there for generations. It's that nobody wants to hunt them for some reason. There's no roads. There's never been a serious enough interest in hunting. It's not like they've gone unnoticed all these years.
Right.
They've sat there and they've been looked at. I look at, I don't know, anywhere from 6 to 10 or 15 ranches each off season and elect to hunt them or not. And look at what our options are there. If we're going to go in and do an exploratory hunt and maybe offer something there in the future. And, 90% of these ranches, they've got, and I hate to, not that we necessarily road hunt, but you've got to have some sort of access to the ranch. You'll have a 30,000-acre ranch with a house down in the corner of it and no way to, you've got to walk out of the back of the house, no way to actually access the mountain ranges. And you're on the Sonora hunt where you're walking in 2-3 miles a day just to get into good deer country. And I run into a handful of those just in the last couple of years that are really tough access-wise. To get up into the mountain ranges. And so an unhunted new ranch is not necessarily a good thing. Now, it might be a great find. You might have just stumbled across something that's fantastic. But for the most part, for decades, outfitters have been touring these ranches and have been offered these ranches, and even the ones without UMAs, without tags on them, in attempts to get tags on them. In my opinion, there's typically a reason that somebody's not hunting it, or it's sat neglected or has been unhunted all these years. Like Arizona or anywhere else, there's not a ton of secrets left in Sonora, It's been relatively well explored by outfitters and hunters, most of the really high quality areas with great genetics and good densities and all that stuff have at least been discovered, for that matter.
Right. Now, it's feasible that I'm going to play devil's advocate here, that, you know, it's just the ranch owner didn't want to allow people on there. And
sure.
Now his son's taken over, and he's like, yeah, why not? Let's make some extra money. You know?
Sure, sure. I actually have one of those situations myself currently, that
good.
They didn't want to hunt for a lot of years because of the owner, and then the younger generation's taken over, and you know, now they're offering hunts, and we've been there for a few years now. So yeah, that's definitely a possibility for sure. But it's just something I noticed, and I just always watch out for. They've usually got a, you know, they haven't been set up for hunting, so there's a poor house or no house. Let me shut this dog up. There's a poor house or no house, and no road system or a limited road system, and just makes them more difficult to hunt.
Now, on those ranches that have limited road system, do you ever consider running horses or anything like that?
We do. We do and have. And that works in a lot of cases. And I guess, for the most part, horses are a little bit iffy sometimes in Sonora.
Uh-huh.
I'm fine on a horse. A lot of our hunters aren't. We've taken some horseback trips up into the mountain ranges on some of these tougher-to-hunt ranches. Access ranches, and most guys do fine, but honestly, it's something that we've tended to stay away from. I've always been super leery of a horseback accident down in Sonora, only because we've had them here in Arizona. We've had them stateside and on tractors in various places, and I would hate for something like that to happen down in Sonora. So safety's always always a number one priority down there. We've done bivy hunts. We've done overnight bivy hunts. We've done horseback hunts, and those are always an option on some of these ranches. But like I said, for whether it be the deer, the access, the house, some factor in the ranch, it's been my opinion, at least in the last few years, that if something's not being hunted, again, unless an owner has chosen not to have his ranch hunt, there's usually a reason for it. There's usually some sort of a reason that nobody has picked that ranch up.
Makes perfect sense.
Yeah. And so
I want to bring something up before I jump into the next question here. There's a lot of shadiness, a lot of underhanded stuff going on in Mexico, and I kind of got caught up in one of those situations myself this year. Booking a hunt. I had booked, and this is what an outfitter that I had sent people with a couple times and never had any issue.
Mm-hmm.
But I think one of the things you need to look at is whether or not that tag fits the ranch that you're hunting.
I started to get into that earlier. When you're talking to your outfitter, once you get to Mexico or beforehand, you've got to make sure that everything matches up. So if you get a tag for Ranch XYZ and you're driving down and he hands you your paperwork and it says, Ranch ABC, and then you show up at, you show up at some different ranch, you can get in trouble for that. And you've got to be aware of that. You've got to know where you're at. You've got to know that your paperwork is correct. You've got to know that you have a tag. There's a lot of overselling, I guess I would call it. A guy gets, say, six tags for a ranch, and he figures, someone's bound to not kill a deer, so let's sell seven hunts or eight hunts, and he'll oversell the hunt, and then some guys tag out on some bucks, and he gets down to the end, and he says, I don't have a tag for you, but I'll find you one. And he goes out and searches for an unused tag from another property, and it's highly illegal and something you've got to really be aware of. I just ended up having an over an hour long meeting with Customs and Border Patrol down there at their office to kind of go over any new regulations and stuff this year. I was down there about 2 weeks ago meeting with them, and they're really cracking down on that kind of stuff this year. When you arrive at the border, everything has got to be filled out and complete, and it all has to match from your gun permit, which ranch it's issued for, to your UMA documents and your hunting contract. and everything down to your tag is all got to be exactly a match. And in theory, that it's supposed to have been where you have been for the last week at that exact ranch. So there's some ranches that don't have tags that get hunted, and they use the tags from the neighboring ranch or something. That's something you've really got to be cautious of when you're talking to your outfitter as far as where we're hunting and how many tags are issued there and how many tags, how many animals is he going to shoot off it from a management standpoint. In some cases, I feel tags are undersubscribed in Mexico. In some places, they're over. Some a ranch may get 20 tags, but it may not have the quality enough habitat to take 20 mature deer off a year. So you've got to manage that and say only take 8 or 10 deer off of those
right.
20 tags. Whereas another ranch may have a half dozen tags. It may have plenty of habitat to take 6 deer, and you can use all the tags in that case. So, you really want to dial that stuff in with your outfitter as far as where you're going and what's going on with the ranch from a management standpoint. I prefer to hunt ranches. I prefer to create my own track records on ranches, essentially. Go in and we hunt them ourselves. My guides hunt them, and some friends of mine hunt them, and we go in and we shoot some actual bucks off them, and we create a track record so that we can go back in the next year and say, yes, we stayed there and hunted there and killed bucks there, and this is what we killed, and we know the genetics, and so on. So we do a little bit of that. Preliminary work.
Next time you need a new ranch checked out, let me know. I'd be happy.
always
on a track record for you.
There's always something.
I'll come in and guns a blazing.
And another thing, when you're talking to your outfitter, you want to know how the hunt is conducted. There's lots of different ways to hunt in lots of different legal ways in Mexico that maybe you guys in the States aren't quite used to. You want to, and certain coos ranches are totally different. You may be going down, you may book a hunt, the guy's got some big bucks on his website and says, come on down and hunt these bucks, and you drive 9 hours south of the border, and you're in box blinds on feeders, sitting little clear cuts and senderos. And that may not have been the coos deer hunt that you had envisioned. Or it may be southeast of Hermosillo in the flats, and you may be hunting water holes at 50 to 100 yards with your new long-range rifle that you just had set up for
right.
this coos hunt, and you realize that nowhere on the ranch can you see 200 yards. Some outfitters hunt exclusively from a high-rack truck where you're expected to jump in the bed of a pickup and get up in a rack, up in a seat, and spend the day slowly touring around the ranch looking for deer and shooting from the rack, or at least spotting from the rack. All of our hunts, being quite the opposite, we spot and stalk, and we use our trucks to drive from vantage point to vantage point and set up big glass and sometimes spend hours glassing, sometimes just spend 20 minutes and move on. We do some hikes up into some rugged country, some day hunts, where we'll go up in the dark in the morning and spend all day hunting up in the mountains and then come back out at dark. We do a little more, what we consider more like traditional coos deer hunting. So you want to know what
right.
you're getting into, and want to know what style of hunting your outfitter offers, and that type
right.
of stuff. So that's definitely something to consider also.
Yeah, and the good thing about that is, you could find the outfitter that caters to your needs, because if you're not physically fit, or if you're impaired or something like that, and you can't do some of these big hikes and you still want to get a coon deer to add to the collection or whatever, you have those options to go shoot on over water or feeder or whatever, or drive around in a truck.
Absolutely.
I know there's a lot of guys out there that are like, I want to go so bad, but I got a bad knee. I can't hike. I can't,
So, sure. But, there's great options for that kind of stuff. And that, there's tons of, there's a big variation in all the options. There's some guys that offer a little bit of both. You can do some spot and stalk or some kind of driving trucks around and glassing from knobs. And then maybe sitting in the afternoon. So if you're a little bit wore out and so you can find somebody that kind of offers what you're after, whether it just be a week in a blind waiting for a big buck to come into water, or a week on foot, just scrambling in the rocks, like a traditional mountain hunt. So, you know, you can kind of go any direction with that. And so definitely when a guy's looking for a hunt, you want to interview a couple outfitters. You want to know what you're getting into, and know what really what he's selling you as far as the style of hunting, because all coos hunts are not the same in Mexico, for sure.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Yeah.
You started mentioning about your paperwork. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, there's just a couple, there's two sets of paperwork that you're going to need, basically. And both of them are pretty simple. If you go with an outfitter should provide all this. We create little folders for each of our clients with all this information in it. But to go to Mexico, to head into Mexico, you're going to need a passport for sure, or a passport card. The days of the driver's license and stuff, birth certificate getting you in are pretty much over. They're requiring a passport now, so be aware of that. You're going to need a passport of some sort. And you're going to need two documents to get your gun in. You're going to need a gun permit from the Mexican government. That's usually done through an outfitter. And it's done down through the office in Hermosillo, and it's tied to your particular ranch. So you'll be issued a tag or issued a gun permit to transport your firearm from the border, say, to that ranch and hunt on that ranch and then take it back. Your gun's not supposed to be anywhere else except between those two places or on that ranch. So the Mexican government will issue you a gun permit. That can be done in 10 days to 2 weeks if you know the right people. Typically it takes a little bit longer. So those are typically done well in advance of the hunts. And so that's something that, so last minute Mexico hunts can be a little bit difficult unless your outfitter has a rifle down there for you to use. And in our case, we typically do. We have two or three nice custom coos rifles down there. So guys, if a guy doesn't have a rifle to bring or is coming on short notice, for example, we can usually accommodate. But you've got to have your Mexican gun permit. And you've got to have a U.S. Customs Form 4457. And it's a small, it's called the Certificate of Registration for Personal Effects Taken Abroad. And it's a little firearms declaration form. It's a small, like, 4x5 form. Mm-hmm. And you're going to fill that out with your gun information, gun make, model, serial number, caliber. And also, and this is reiterated to us this year for the first time ever, they want your scopes and your binoculars, anything else of very high value. You can buy a set of Swarovski binoculars down in Hermosillo if you wanted to, and then you could bring them back and not pay the taxes, basically the taxes on them. So you've got to declare that you're taking your items in, and so all you do is fill out the simple form. You'd list Swarovski EL 10x42s and a serial number, list your spotting scope, maybe an expensive camera, anything of very high value will go on this form. Mm-hmm. This form, when you enter Mexico, the U.S. side, the U.S. Border Patrol, will check your 4457 form, and they will have to stamp it and confirm it and check all your serial numbers. You can fill that out at the border. You don't need to show up with that in advance. You can print one off the internet and fill it out in advance, and then have it stamped and checked upon your arrival at the border. And so I recommend doing that if you want to just save 5 minutes and do all your paperwork at home. You can just simply Google Form 4457, and it's the first thing that comes up. It's a U.S. Customs declaration form. Print it out, fill it out, take it down there, they'll stamp it, and then once you've done that, that form is good for multiple years. I'm not sure how long exactly, but you can keep that in your gun case and use that stamped form to go in and out of Mexico each time. That's all you'll need for U.S. customs. But as soon as you pull across the border, mm-hmm. you'll need to present your gun permit. You no longer need your 4457. That's a U.S. form. So you'll need to pull out your gun permit. And the aduana, the Mexican immigration there, will check your gun. They'll check your serial number, match it up to your paperwork. They'll want to know that you have as many or less rounds of ammunition that are stated on your permit. It's 100 round maximum per firearm, and you're allowed two firearms. So you can bring a a shotgun and a deer rifle, or a deer rifle and a coyote rifle, with up to 100 rounds of ammo each. And so you'll check those in with Mexican immigration, and then you'll immediately go to the Mexican military. Now, that's different from Douglas to Nogales to Sasebe. Sasebe and Douglas, very easy. It's very close. They're very handy. They come right out. They stamp your, give you some signatures and a stamp on the back of your gun permits, and they check your serial numbers and sign you in. In Nogales, it's a little bit more of a process because you've got to drive kind of across town. Some days they have a military official there at the border that can save you about a half hour or an hour. He's not always there, though. But you have to be
checked in by those. I actually got sent, when I went through Douglas last year, I got sent to the military base.
Yes.
And I had to sit there and wait 2 hours.
Oh, wow.
For the guy that was capable of checking me in. So I busted my butt to get down to the border right when it opened so I wouldn't lose a day of hunting.
Uh-huh.
Or lose that half a day of hunting, which ended up I lost anyway because there was no way of getting down there fast enough. But
sure.
Yeah, that was interesting. So
sometimes in Nogales you can do both the Mexico steps, the mm-hmm. the immigration check and the military check. Sometimes you can do them both at the port at the same time.
Right.
And that can save you a ton of time. If not, you've got to go to the military base. In Sasebe, where we tend to cross a lot, the military base is only about a half mile into Sonora. And it's, you pull right up to it. They come right out. They're super helpful. They check all our guns and ammunition and sign our paperwork, and then we're off to the ranch.
Right.
So it's really not a big process. Nogales and Douglas both have taken more time for us. So I know what you're talking about there in Douglas. Nogales, they can simply make you wait for an hour or two, and it's happened before. So definitely a lot of time to check your guns in. When you return at the end of your trip, you have to do the same process in reverse. They have assured me that they're now tracking that, and they're making sure that everyone checks their guns in and then checks them back out with the military, then immigration, and then, of mm-hmm. course, you've got to represent your 4457 to the U.S. side upon reentry. So we've got to check guns in and then check them back out at the end. You do the exact same process, but you do it in reverse. And so that gets your gun, your firearm, in and out with your Mexican gun permit and your U.S. Form 4457. Now, to get a deer back in is a little bit of a different process. You need four documents to get your deer in, and they'll all have to be completely filled out and your tag signed before you arrive at the border. And do not attempt to do this with an agent at the border. You want to do this at the ranch before you leave and make sure you and your whole gang have got all your paperwork completed. Some things that will come with your gun permit that you will need, the first thing you'll need is a permiso de cacería, and that is your Mexican hunting contract. It says permiso de cacería across the top. It is simply a basic contract between you and the ranch. It states the ranch owner's information, your gun information, and just some very basic information that needs to be signed. You'll also have a copy of the UMA registration, and UMA is like a unit to us in Arizona. It's how the ranch is looked at or managed by the Game and Fish Department. And so there's a registration form. You actually need the original because it's two-sided, and the back side will have an official signature on it from the Seminat Agati's guys, the Game and Fish guys. And mm-hmm. so you need your UMA document in addition to your permiso de cacería, and then you'll need two forms from the U.S. government. You can pull both of these up online. I recommend printing out some copies, printing out extras, printing some for your buddies, taking them down with you. The first one you'll need is a USDA form, and it's the USDA's Notice of Arrival. And I believe it's called PPQ Form 368. But if you Google notice of arrival, you will need that form. And then there's also the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Form 3-177. We just call them a 3177, but a 3-177 form are the two U.S. documents. And those are essentially declarations that you're bringing wildlife in. And so you've got to state what condition the wildlife's in and so on, and what you're bringing in. You'll actually place your tag numbers and so on there. And then, of course, your deer has to be affixed with a plastic Sonora tag that has to be signed by you. And so essentially there's five things, including the actual deer tag that's on your rack. You'll need that, and then the four documents: Permiso de Caceria, the UMA registration, the notice of arrival, and the 3177.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are what will get your deer back in. If your deer is in the right state, which means it needs to be boiled, the skull cap needs to be boiled free of any meat and or tissue. So if a guy wants to bring a Euro mount back and he wants to bring his whole skull, you essentially have to do it in Mexico. You have to get all the brain matter out. You've got to get everything off.
Mm-hmm.
You want a white skull. Much easier to do if you're just bringing a skull cap back. But you've got to be cleaned, boiled, and white to bring it back. And so if you're going to try to do a Euro, I recommend taking yourself a half day at the end of the trip and making sure you can actually get it done before you have to end up skull capping it to cross the border anyway. So that's something to consider. And then your cape. Your cape needs to be frozen and inspectable. And so we don't really want our capes to freeze thaw. We can spoil capes pretty easily that way.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to have your cape hard frozen. So no matter where you're hunting or what you're doing, you have to have access to a freezer. That's
right.
The absolute number one thing in Sonora. You have to have a freezer, a good freezer at that matter, because you've got to hard freeze your capes. So what we do is we lay our capes skin to skin, lay them out flat, and then hang them over a little metal bar in the freezer so that all the hide is showing and there's only one fold in the hide. So we keep them stacked in an ice chest. We present them for inspection to U.S. Customs, and they can see the entire hair side, the entire hide of the deer, by mm-hmm. only unfolding maybe the one crease if they've just defrosted the slightest bit. If you've got them rolled up tight, they can't inspect them, and they will either make you wait until they saw and are inspectable. They could confiscate them, but the reason for all this is there cannot be any ticks on the cape, live or dead ticks, tick carcasses, anything resembling a tick. We bring dog brushes down, little tick and flea brushes for dogs, and we comb out all our capes very thoroughly. And that's another reason for hanging them in the freezer, is a lot of live ticks will escape. If you roll your cape up and set it in the freezer, the ticks will bury to the center of the cape, to the warmest part, and then you've got ticks frozen inside your cape. So you can't have any ticks on your cape when you hit the border, and it has to be inspectable, but preferably frozen in our case. They say you've got to vouch basically that it's been frozen for 24 hours. You've got to sign
right.
an affidavit that swears that it's been frozen for 24 hours. But it has to be inspectable. So the officials this year, they said, well, just defrost it or thaw it out, you know, about halfway or for your drive back so that when you get here, it's inspectable, but we can tell that it's been frozen. Well, it's kind of hard to do. It's kind of a big gray area. What's frozen, what's not.
Sounds like a
how
giant
can we pain
tell
in the ass. Frozen? So what we agreed with them is that we are going to leave the capes, all of the hair exposed, and put the skin to skin. We'll comb all the ticks out as well as we can, and we're going to hang them like you would hang a towel on a towel rack and
right.
freeze them hard that way so that they stack flat in an ice chest. And that when the guy pulls him out of an ice chest, he can see the entire cape, and it's inspectable, and he can make sure that there's no ticks on it. And we were also assured this year, and they've had some leniency in the past, that if there is a tick on your tape, it will be confiscated and you will be cited and fined. Yes. So, and
Euro-mounted.
I'm sure that was a little bit of a scare tactic, but I know they're going to confiscate some capes this year. It happens every year. It happens to lots and lots of people every year. It's all related to ticks. So if you want to get your cape back, bring a little brush, bring a comb, spend some major time getting ticks out, and then freeze it so that it's inspectable by the U.S. Customs.
Yep. Euro-mounted is for me.
Euro-mounted is. So then you've got to do your Euro down there. It's been a half day ticking at your skull and boiling away down there to get that done. So,
that's all right.
Yeah, so it's a tough deal either way. But it's all doable. It's all fun. It sounds a little daunting because there's a few steps involved that, say, Arizona or Western guys aren't quite used to. But it's really not that bad if you go down with somebody who's done it a lot and knows the routine, knows the people, has relationships built, say like we do with, folks in town and customs officials and such. They know us, and so it helps make the process a little bit easier.
Right.
We're very open with them and meet with them a lot on how we can adjust our program to make things work. So also, before you head back to the border, and before you head for Mexico, you should probably need to Google the number of the wildlife official or inspector at the port you're crossing at.
Mm-hmm.
If you get in one of these long days and you're headed back from a ranch that's pretty deep and you end up with two flat tires and then you stop for tacos and you get back to the border at 5 or 6 p.m., there may or may not be an official there to inspect your wildlife. So you need to call that guy. And even the guys in the Dallas have been flexible with us. And we say, hey, I'm on my way. I'm still 2 hours out. What can we do? I know you're getting off work pretty soon. And they've been very flexible. We've always made it work. But you don't just want to show up at a random time necessarily to the border. You want to take a few minutes, Google up the right numbers, depending on which border you're crossing. An example of that being Sasebe, Arizona. Lots of guys are hunting northwestern Sonora, and they're accessing it through Sasebe, which is a great, easy port to cross through. Very friendly guys on both sides. But they only cross deer on Wednesdays and Fridays. So if you come back, if you depart your trip on a Saturday or a Thursday and you show up at the border with a deer, you can absolutely not bring it through the border. You'll be directed to go back through Nogales. So it's about a 2.5 hour drive back around through Nogales to go import your deer. So you've got to know that stuff. I believe you can import a Douglas. You know what? Don't quote me on that. I'm not sure what Douglas is doing this year. But I know, Nogales is pretty much every day wide open, and if you call, you can do it later in the day. Sasebe is Wednesdays and Fridays only. After 10 a.m., it's actually 10 to 2 or 10 to 3, they'll have a wildlife official there. So you've got to plan your trip around some of that stuff to make sure that things go smooth and that when you get to the border, there's an official there, you can get checked out and move on your way. And you don't show up at the border at 8 and you're waiting for an official to get on duty at 10,
Yeah, no, it sucks.
Yeah, for sure. So,
one more question about hunting in Mexico, and then I actually want to jump into a little bit about javelina hunting, since that's coming up here in Arizona. Actually, Friday, over-the-counter javelina opens, so, what are some of the things like actually traveling to and through Mexico should a guy expect?
So totally depends on where you're going and how far. There's lots and lots of places that you can hunt in Sonora where you never end up passing through any sort of a checkpoint or anything. You may buzz through a few small towns, villages, but there's a few places that you've got to pass checkpoints. So no matter what, when you're traveling with your guns, once you've checked your gun in with the the U.S. Customs and Mexican Customs and the Mexican military, and you're on the road officially, you're going to want to leave your gun relative. You obviously had it in and out of the truck three times at this point, and you're going to want to leave it relatively accessible, and you're going to want to have those gun permits likely on your dash. And so, for example, if you pull up to a checkpoint or you get stopped for any reason, local police officer stops you, that is the absolute first and only thing he's going to want to see and or know about is the firearms that you're carrying. And they are going to check your serial numbers and check your gun permits, just like the military and the customs did. You've got no worries. They've already been checked twice at this point, so you know that things are good and you shouldn't have any sort of hassles. But you will be checked. They'll ask you some questions. I end up going through a handful of checkpoints each year. I've never in my life had an issue at all. They've just it's never been anything but a few questions. We're very open. We come in. We pull up with smiles on our face. We know the routine. I'm not there to argue them or fight with them and not want them to search my truck. We know we're going to Mexico. We know what we're getting into. So you've got a little bit of time and a little bit of patience traveling through Mexico. So if you're headed down to one of these places that's 6, 7, 8 hours south of Mexico, you're likely going to pull, in addition to the three times at the border, you're likely going to pull your guns out 2 or 3 or 4 more times and get them checked by somebody before you get to the ranch. That should never be an issue. You don't ever have to slip somebody a 20 or any of those things you've heard. That stuff's really rare. It just doesn't happen as far as problems go. But you're likely to get checked, especially on those longer drives. Just show them your paperwork and check your passport real quick and match it up with everything. And usually you're just on your way. No worries at all. So, So as far as that goes, we tend to travel only during the day. I schedule all my trips. We do morning crossing. And even no matter how far the ranch is down there, I want to be on the ranch at the house long before sunset. So, and if I'm leaving the ranch, I don't ever pull out of the ranch and head for Arizona at noon or 2 in the afternoon because I know I'm not going to make it there by dark. From a safety standpoint, traveling through the towns and everything, we do 100% of our travel during daylight hours. So that's just a little rule we've got. And all these years, we've never had an issue. We've got lots of friends in lots of these towns now, and lots of rancher friends, and we just bounce from friends to friends, and that just we've been essentially have a great time down there for 6, 7 weeks a year.
Awesome, good deal. One last little note I'm going to throw in there. I had this issue. With my 2016 Chevy Silverado, because it's a diesel, and Mexican diesel is not as good as American
it's
diesel.
Not as good, but they've switched over. Pemex this last year has got all pumps in Sonora switched over to the low low sulfur diesel extra low sulfur diesel or whatever. So yeah, it's brand new. They're pumping better diesel into Sonora, it's something to check on if you've got a diesel truck. But depending on where you're going, you should be able to get diesel. Do note that you are not allowed to bring fuel into Mexico.
Not more than 2 gallons.
Yes, you
can bring 2 gallons.
Yeah, that's right. We always show up with – you guys show up with a 5 or a pair of 5. And sometimes there's some leniency to let you in with a 5-gallon jug or something. That's happened before. But for the most part, you need to show up with empty fuel cans. They're not gonna want you bringing fuel into Sonora. So show up with empty fuel cans, as many as you want. Across the border, when you get in Nogales or Magdalena or wherever, Douglas, wherever you're, Agua Prieta, wherever you're crossing, you can get Pemex, you can fill all your cans up and you're good to go. But you're going to want to do that in Sonora.
That's for sure.
If you do that at a major town, you can actually do that on a visa these days.
Awesome. I'm glad that they switched that over, because that was a big pain in the neck. I ended up having to take my wife's truck, which is a gas car. You have no problem with gas, but the diesel was throwing. A lot of guys are telling me to throw your truck into limp mode.
Yeah, exactly. That's what was going on. And you can Google up a bunch of forum posts and stuff about that. Guys had a lot of issues over the years. Guys, you know, like we're stuck in limp mode 6 hours south of the border and stuff. So it's been a big issue, but I believe it's been solved now. Just as of the last 12 months or so, I believe that's going to be a non-factor moving forward.
Cool. Good deal. Well, I want to quickly jump into some javelina questions just because it got thrown at me, and I wasn't going to do a complete show, or complete episode, rather, on javelina. So like I said, it's coming up hot. December 7th, the over-the-counter tags are valid until the end of December. So we got a couple weeks of over-the-counter archery in the metro units here in Arizona. What are some of the tactics that you use to, you know, to score one of these little stink piggies?
Sure. I love hunting these things, man. We've been hunting them for years. They're a ton of fun. Most of what we do, almost all of what we do, is just exclusively spot and stalk. We're just setting up the glass, our tripods, picking country apart, you know, just inch by inch and looking for pigs. The later seasons, as we get in here in December, January, through February, we're looking for pigs in the early morning on those, like, sunlit south, southeast-facing slopes. The first place to hit the sun, they're going to get up and sun themselves and see, be a little bit more visible this time of year from about now on through the rest of the hunting seasons. And so spot and stalks are kind of our number one tactic. And as we spot and stalk, we've always got a call in hand. Or some of, you know, we usually go in, at least two or three of us go in together with a bow or two or a weapon or two to move in on them. And when we shoot a javelina or we miss a javelina or we bust the javelina out at, say, close range, we'll get on that varmint call. And we can oftentimes turn them back around for a second opportunity, you know, to redeem a missed shot maybe, or have your buddy shoot one. We pulled a lot of doubles that way. So I'd say that's mostly our routine, is getting up on a big knob in the morning as high as we can. And I want the sun at my back in the morning, and I'm looking west or slightly north at those big lit up slopes, the first places the sun's going to hit. This is especially evident in, like, say, central and southern Arizona. You've got those big yellow grass hills, and those pigs will get out there first thing in the morning. It makes them a little bit easier to spot. But for the most part, pigs are where you find them, is what they always say. But for the most part, I'm usually hunting pigs that I already know about. So I've got just over a dozen javelina herds at this point that are kind of in my memory bank that we selectively take a few javelina from. And that would encompass multiple units across the state from almost Flagstaff to Nogales. Mm-hmm. And I'll usually go in and hunt a javelina or two out of one unit. But I tend to go back to the exact same spots, hunt the exact same herds that I hunted last year and the year before and the year before. We try to never be too hard on them, never take more than one or two javelina out of any one pod in a season. And doing that and hunting some of these kind of oddball herds that I've found that don't seem to get a lot of other pressure, we've just allowed us to hunt the same herds just year after year after year. So go back where you've seen javelina in the past, basically. If you've hunted javelina there in the past and you know them and you've been in there and you've lost them down in the creek bottom and you've seen them up on the big ridge, go back there, because those javelina likely live there or very nearby, and you can often find pigs in the same spot that during that same time of year that you were there last time.
Oh yeah, that was for sure. I killed my first javelina. Jeez, I don't remember. The first time I put in for it, I guess, was 98, something like that, down in 36C, A. And I literally killed probably a javelina off that same hillside every year for 10 years after that.
I moved down to southern Arizona like 15 years ago, down to Tubac, Arizona. And the first javelina I killed once I moved down there ran off about 20 yards, and he died next to a big mesquite tree on this ridge. A year later, the second javelina I killed died on the other side of the tree, about 7 feet from where the first one did. And about 5 years later, like the seventh or eighth javelina I killed died about 30 yards to the north of that tree.
That's hilarious.
So I killed three of them that all ended up dying in the size of your backyard in the small radius over a period of multiple years. Just by sheer luck, I kept going in there, herd in the same general spot. I'd shoot them, they'd bail off, they'd end up dying within 20 yards of each other.
Wow.
It's just really funny how those things work out. So, but that's my number one advice, is go back where you've hunted javelina in the past, where you know there's pigs, or where you've seen a ton of sign, and you get down in those thick cat claw bottoms, and you figure out where they've just been living in there and rooting in there. Spend your time in those spots and just keep the glass working. Just keep glassing, glassing, glassing. This time of year, there's no bad time to glass for javelina. You can glass javelina essentially all day long. They go back down. They could be up and visible at any time. So I don't ever just go hunt for 2 hours in the morning and go hang out. We hunt pigs all day long during the winter. Keep the glass moving and keep the predator call handy.
There you go. Now, if you're hunting the flats, do you ever do, I've heard, I haven't done this myself, but guys if you were running lines, so to speak, you cut a track and you get on tracks and follow the tracks.
I've done that with limited success. And essentially almost more of a scouting technique. You find a bunch of javelina tracks, they going up a wash and look real fresh, and you follow them, end up following them a few hundred yards, and you come across, you turn the corner in the wash, and you come across their bedroom. You come across,
right.
You know, and you're like, oh, now that helped. You know, now I found where these pigs are really living. Maybe it wasn't quite where you were hunting before. So don't be afraid to do stuff like that and follow those tracks, see where those pigs are going. If you find a little pig freeway, you've got tracks going both directions, through some little gap or a saddle or up a wash, follow, figure out where they're going. Figure out what it is, why they're running up and down that. Is there water at one end and cover and bedding at the other? Or what's the reason for all the tracks? There's usually a reason. There's usually, those pigs are in there close. They don't tend to move great distances, unless kind of pushed by hunters. And even when they do, in that case, they'll often come right back to their home range within 24 or 48 hours.
Right. So that being said, what's that one sign that you see when you come across and you see it and you're like, I'm going to kill javelina in here?
Ooh, I don't know. That's a good question. It's got to be a combination of a ton of things, man. You got some history there or a ton of fresh sign. Honestly, those huge, and I'm talking about the biggest ones, not your just general prickly pear hillsides, but the huge hills that have got a full southern face or southeastern face of prickly pear, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of yards across. You back up a half mile from one of those and put the glass to work on them. There's usually a herd of pigs on just about every one of them that I can think of, from the border to the Verde Valley. There's a, you get in that right country with the right amount of feed and cover. But this time of year, you're looking for those big south, southeast facing slopes. I'm looking pretty high up on them. I tend to feel that in the wintertime, I see a lot of pigs in the upper third of our hills and small mountains and such. So I tend to look a little bit higher. I feel like I find a few more javelina higher than I do down low. We're talking about one piece of country. This time of year, I think they pretend to be a little bit higher, and in the summertime, they're down a little bit lower in the shady bottoms and feeding
a little bit
lower. Now you got the flats around the metro area where the pigs are where they are. The pigs are out in the flats. The pigs are up on those volcanic cones. Just about wherever they want to be that particular day.
Yeah.
But at least they're out moving this time of year. That's for sure. We're getting to be that time of year.
Cool. Well, that's all I got for you today. If anybody's interested in going on a quality Mexico hunt for coos deer, for mule deer, definitely get a hold of Matt Woodward and Borderland Adventures. Matt, where can they find out about you?
Sure, they can find us on Instagram, website www.borderlandadventures.com. Pretty easy to track down. Although we are in Mexico for the next 6 or 7 weeks, so we're not on the phone all day long. But would love to have anyone down in Mexico, and it's a ton of fun down there. It's a lot different than you'd think. It's very safe. It's always a great time. We have nothing but a good time down there and tons of fun.
Yeah.
And we kill some great bucks. So.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. If you try to do it on your own, you can get into a world of hurt. But you go down there with somebody like Matt, who's been down there a bunch and knows his shit. It's a pretty seamless and fun adventure. So.
Appreciate it.
For sure, absolutely. You know, that's my cautionary tale for you, is that I've done it on my own now, and I don't recommend you do it. I mean, I'm still here to talk about it, but I started
doing it on my own, so I understand that.
Yeah, for sure. Well, thanks for coming on, man, and we will talk to you soon.
My pleasure, John. Take care.